This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, happy Christmas and welcome to Audioscope. I'm joined today for a special Christmas edition by Des Kenny, the Chief Executive of the National Council for the Blind of Ireland. Happy Christmas, Des.
And the same to you and to our listeners, Bethan.
2006 has been the 75th anniversary of the National Council for the Blind of Ireland, but also it's 20 years since you've been CEO. You've been CEO for 20 years.
Yes, I joined the organisation in November, in fact, of 1986. So this was the 20th year of my employment with NCBI and the 75th anniversary of the organisation founded back in 1931. I wasn't around at that time.
You hasten to add.
I would hasten to add, yes.
20 years within the organisation. How did you first get involved with the National Council for the Blind of Ireland?
I suppose really it's a longer trail than just the starting out in 1986, in that I had, from the time I left school, which again was a special school for the blind because I lost my sight at the age of 9, and had to attend special school. But I would have started my working life with the National League of the Blind and then gone to the Irish Association for the Blind, left Blind Welfare for 6 years and gone to DFI, or the equivalent of it as it now is. So I was all the time around the edges of what was happening within the services and agencies for blind people. So I would have known of the pending post in NCBI, and I would have been encouraged to apply for that at a time when I was Chief Executive of the Union of Voluntary Organisations, which was the old name for DFI. So that's how I would have known. I would have been close to the grapevine.
And so you went, obviously, for the job of CEO of NCBI, and in some ways the rest is history. Do you think that going for the job as Chief Executive as a blind person, would that have stood to your favour? Was the previous chief executive blind or vision impaired?
No, if anything, it would have been something that might have militated against consideration. But there were a couple of very good advocates of change in the council. We'd gone through, if you like, in 1981, the International Year of Disabled People. There was an emerging change of the need for people with disabilities generally to be involved, not alone in boards, but also seen to be involved at the helm of things. And that kind of pressure within the NCBI by one or two advocates would have helped that arrive. But the organisation, in many ways, was very much at the dawn of its own awakening. I think in their own way, they didn't realise how momentous it might have been. Because if you think about it, even today you won't find many chief executives with the disability type of the agency that represents that form of disability.
Yeah, most of the voluntary groups are headed by, or voluntary groups for disabled people are headed by non-disabled people, and they may have disabled people on their boards, but not necessarily sort of in the top managerial role. I'm sure that was even more the case 20 years ago. It's incredible.
Very much so. And the organisation, I think it was enlightened. There was always the tradition, though, you see, with the National League of the Blind, where you had the late Paddy Lyons, who would have been there before me, and he had gone then on to the NRB, as it was now, the NDA. So blind people had been seen to be active and contributing to the debate and the lobby around the issues for sight loss, and also had been seen to perform some administrative duties. I, at that time, before joining the NCBI, had been chief executive of quite a large umbrella body of diverse disabilities for 6 years.
And how is that going from a diverse disability group to specifically working, with blind or for, or in an organisation solely dedicated to one disability? That
I think any kind of progression in work has to accumulate some new skills, some some new abilities. And I think what it would have given me was an insight into the fact that when you talk about prejudice or you talk about things that you might see as solely related to blindness, if you sit only on one side of the table, in fact, is a very common theme throughout a lot of disability groups, the non-inclusion in the decision-making processes, the exclusion by society. All of the language, in fact, is similar. The type of disability is the thing that makes it different.
And in many ways, in terms of the workings of organisations, the type of disability might be quite irrelevant in some ways.
It is, because a lot of it is about systems, methods and ways of delivering services. The services might be different in terms of what they might be targeting as an end product to make people, say, more mobile in our case. But in the case of somebody who uses a wheelchair, probably to show them how to drive.
I'm sure NCBI has changed an awful lot within the last 20 years. What are the major changes that you've seen, you know, throughout your time in NCBI?
When I came into the organisation, we were just moving out of the old era of the council's founding tenets, which were around home teacher for the blind. The home teachers were the first intervention workers for blind people in Ireland, similar to workers in the UK, who taught blind people communication skills. At that time, you were looking at typewriting and Moon and Braille as the three primary communication skills. And they also taught them craft skills in order to keep people occupied and to give them some means of earning. So they would have taught rush mat making. St. Bridget's crosses would have been made by, and light basketry. So they were the handicrafts of the time. And that was all performed by the home teachers for the blind. But they were then certified by a college called College for Home Teachers, which had its demise in, you know, 2 years before I joined the council. So there was a big dilemma going on and debate, where do we find our new skill base? And just before I entered, the decision had been taken that social work could probably be the profession and background of the people who ultimately would work with vision impaired people. And there were some technical skills courses in mobility and DLS, daily living skills, that could be added to that. So that's what I would have seen myself actually assembling at the time, the skill base of the home teacher for the blind, which then became the social worker for the blind. And in a way, I didn't like, and a lot of vision impaired people at the time wouldn't have liked, the concept of social worker, because it suggested that the vision impaired person was impoverished in a kind of monetary sense, or was somehow in need of treatments or remedies around some kind of deficiencies. Social work now is a more inclusive rather than exclusive type profession seen today, you know, 20 years ago. So we created a title of community resource worker for our staff and skilled them with the new technical skills of how to get around and mobility. So the organisation evolved from that time. I think we had 30 staff. Today we have 160 staff.
And you've branched out even more so than, well, I'm sure the community resource workers remain the backbone in many ways of the services. There's a lot more than just community resource workers now, aren't there?
Yes, but they still are the community resource workers. The workers we started with the change of title and the enrichment of the skills, that they're still the front line of the service. You would still have about 60 of those who are the primary contact and who mediate the changes that vision impaired people require to improve their coping skills and to generally enrich their lives and improve the quality of their lives. One of the other things, actually, which would have been an interesting thing that helped move the organisation forward, oddly enough, was to bring into it a change. My working life started way back in 66 with the Irish Association for the Blind. It no longer exists. And the reason it doesn't is because it was subsumed into the NCBI back in 1988, 2 years after I came into the NCBI. And that meant that we were taking in the whole library service and recording services of that organisation. So that gave us a means of diversifying and opening the windows on the more restricted service provisions of the NCBI at the time. So that did help in two ways. It provided an extra dimension, but it also provided a broader focus that there were more things in the world of sight loss than just interventions to make people mobile, improve their coping skills and whatnot, and that the whole means of communication took on a new, took on a whole new look from the concepts of typewriting and teaching people Moon, which was the raised form of print for blind people, and teaching them Braille.
And things have continued to change, that the focus has continued to change beyond those areas of communication and mobility, haven't they? That NCBI is broader than that even now.
We have moved the organisation on considerably into the whole era of technology, and what that's improving the skills of the individual, but also we've moved into improving the environment where the vision impaired person goes to and lives. Because I suppose when the organisation started, we were trying to look after people in their own homes and to give them skills and abilities to keep themselves amused and probably to earn small money from craft work. As we went on and as society became more accepting of an inclusive place for people with sight loss in society, we had to move forward and we obtained bus passes, free travel for people because they now could move around. We would have shown people how to get around safely by introducing mobility. And all of that meant also that we had later on to start looking at the environment where people moved around and promote the use of audible crossings, tactile paving. And today we spend a lot of time trying to persuade people who supply public transport or who manage the environment, from streetscapes to officescapes, to make those places accepting of not only just blind people, but the change has also come around that we're actually dealing with people with low vision, as distinct from the past of people only with no vision.
And well, something that people often say, that they're initially afraid of contacting the National Council for the Blind because they think they're not blind, and don't realise that the majority of the people registered with NCBI have low vision, have some useful vision, rather than being totally blind.
That's correct, yeah, that somewhere in the region of 82%, I think, is the statistic of the people using our services, they have some usable residual vision. And that's why, in a way, that one of the things that we attempted in this year, the 75th anniversary of the organisation, was a name change, that we're dropping National Council for the Blind as the long title of the organisation, and we're using a shorter name, just the initials of the organisation, NCBI, and a strapline, which is a way of actually describing what the organisation does in a number of words. So our strapline is working for people with sight loss. So the word blind is disappearing out of how we use and represent our information out to people.
So that more people will have a better understanding of the work, is it?
They will have a better understanding that the work of the organisation can include them. The work of the organisation for people who are totally blind and who need the interventions around total sight loss won't change. In fact, they will continue to improve and be enriched. But for those people who can use the low vision type services and can use all of the coping skills that sight loss in a general sense requires us to transmit to people, that those people will feel less intimidated using NCBI, because we should be passing on services like our low vision service rather than the name of the organisation. You can go to our low vision service to see low vision aids, so you can learn about what's available by way of technologies from low vision aids right up to CCTVs or computers with magnification. So the agency is no longer just about total sight loss and Braille and things blind. It's about things low vision.
So people can make use of what vision they have.
They have, and that's what we were. Years ago when I was growing up, there was a whole myth around the fact that if people were to use their residual vision, they'd lose it. you know. So now it's all about using it and ensuring that people can have the tools, the ways, the techniques, and the little device, handheld devices, to electronic gadgets to actually do that.
How do you see the organisation moving in the future, or what are your main aims or hopes for the organisation over the next number of years?
Well, what we're doing in 2007 is we're going to launch a five-year strategic plan for NCBI. That plan, then, as we go through the 5 years, each year will have its own business plan to move the organisation forward. I think the things that will move the organisation on over the next into the next year is greater inclusion of vision impaired people in a meaningful way in the actual shaping of the service that they get. Now, to some extent, we run an organisation dissimilar, not dissimilar to a shop. It's not exactly like a shop, but I just use the analogy that there are things on the shelves called services, and you take those services if you want them. But as we go along, those items on the shelf can be modified or changed by listening to the service user and tweak, so that while we might continue to offer the same array of services, we will try and enrich them and modify them.
So you can go into the shop and say, I'd like you to stock X service, or I'd like you to change that type of service so that it meets my needs in this way.
That's right. Well, I wouldn't like to promise a service, but I would use maybe a way the organisation might go. So, totally blind people have difficulty sometimes in going on holidays because there's nobody to go with. Maybe the organisation might find a facility or a means of meeting the cost of the extra consequence of having to take somebody who isn't a family member or whatnot. We do this currently with skiing because it is necessary to have an instructor with you when you go skiing full-time. It costs probably 500 or 600 euro on a week of skiing. The organisation pays for that. And I think they're the kind of things that the organisation will probably move forward as we go on, that through listening to people and working very closely with them. It's not that we don't listen at the minute. What we will be doing is trying as best we can to respond to a lot of that listening and build more flexible units of service around that. So partnership is really what it's about with the service user, listening and partnership. And the other one then is collaboration, that we will have to have a more dynamic working relationship with our sister organisations in the area of sight loss.
Do you enjoy your job?
Yes, I think I probably love it, a lot. It's a difficulty when you actually come to work in something as a consequence of the disability that you have going into it. There's a danger that the boundaries aren't very clear between your work and between your own lifestyle as a blind person. So if you didn't like it, it could become a huge burden to me. I think because I do like it, I spend a lot of time at it, and I do love it.
In what way can boundaries become, or what? How do you manage sort of the boundaries?
I think I manage them fairly okay. I would tend to spend, I have a fairly rich family life, so my family life is a total distraction from my work life. But it could become a fixation with me. You're never free of blindness. When you drop something, you instantly are blind again. You can't find it so readily. If you need to read something, it's coming at you from something that you probably produced on your own printing presses at work, or if you're listening to a computer, it's probably software that works. And if it doesn't work, it's probably your own organisation as the consequence of it not working. So you're surrounded all of the time by the interventions that your organisation provides. So you're all the time aware of things that go wrong and things that can be improved. So it's a kind of an alertness. It's operating probably at a subliminal or subconscious level. But for some people, it probably could become your obsession as well, you know, but people will think that you're never off duty. And in the early days, less so now. When I was with the National League of the Blind, people would ring and you would be talking at meetings or in pubs about issues of blind welfare and about the whole context in which, you know, blind people, vision impaired people lived at that time.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one, isn't it, that you're, when you're CEO of the main service provider, and yet almost as part of who you are, you're also a service user of that service. I can understand how it could get quite confusing.
Hmm.
Are you taking much time off over Christmas? Do you have Christmas holidays?
Yes, I take the week off. We closed on the Friday and we'll open now the Tuesday after New Year's Day. It's a shorter closing period this year, but it'll be a nice rest. We have family, a son over from Australia, and it's a time to catch up. I was ill in the early part of the year, and it's a nice time to reflect and just be at rest.
Well, wish you all the very best for Christmas and enjoy the break, and presumably we'll be talking to you again over the course of the time in Audioscope. Des Kenny, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/Radio 1.